Welcome to episode 282 of the Reformed Brotherhood. I'm Jesse.
And I'm Tony, and we are proud members of the Society of Reformed Podcasters. Hey, brother.
Hey, brother. Well, it finally happened. You have increased your family by 50%.
I have.
Congratulations.
Yes. Little August Jesse arrived on March 7th at 11:55 a.m. And I don't think I've slept more than maybe, I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours each night. So please forgive any insanity or accidental heresy that happens on this podcast. I mean, that's a good general principle anyways, but I'm not all here. My sleep is definitely interrupted, but it's worth every second of it. So I have this nice, sweet moments in the evening because we're doing our, I'll talk about this more in a little while, but we're doing nighttime on shifts. And so I have the first shift. And so I have like 4 hours that he's usually really fussy and he doesn't want to sleep. So I just sit and hold him and watch movies. It's really kind of a nice time. I read chapter one of Calvin's Institutes to him already. And we've been through most, you know, first part of Genesis. So we're making progress.
Train a child up. Listen, there's so many things that I love about that. Please tell me though, that you guys kind of catalog this by like watches. So like kind of in the biblical style, like watches in the night.
Yeah.
Like in the third watch, you come to him.
I call them watches. I call them like first, second, third watch or like the ninth hour.
Yeah. I love this. I also feel like you've hyped up this particular episode. So now that people have heard that you've just had this lovely baby. And by the way, he is a good looking child.
Is. Yeah, we should just turn this episode into talking about the baby, but
we really should.
Yeah, so my wife had a cesarean section, and so I don't know. I'm sure there are listeners out there who have wives or are wives who have had cesarean sections, but they put the woman in there and they put up all the surgical draping, and so basically from like her rib cage up is where dad and mom sit and are you can see, and then below that is where they're operating on her. And the doctor, as they're pulling the baby out, yells out kind of like, oh my gosh, that's one of the cutest babies I've ever seen. And then some nurse on the other side of the room yells out, he doesn't even look like an old man. So apparently he came out. I mean, usually C-section babies are a little bit less squished up and weird looking than normal right. babies or natural birth babies. But he came out just like totally proportional. He's just adorable. He's already got this little personality. It's just, well, this is a good episode for us to gush about the baby because we're talking about pre-fall anthropology. So we'll get into image of God topics and kind of be fruitful and multiply topics. But yeah, he's great. He's healthy. He's a big boy. He came out at 10 pounds, 21 inches. So he's actually not that chubby. He's really long. And so he looks more like a little baby, not like a little sumo wrestler baby. Right. So he's, to quote one of the doctors, he's well proportioned. So like his body is not
Agreed.
All squished up. He's long and he's actually kind of thin for a baby. So, but he's such a little funny dude. He makes himself known in funny ways. You can already tell he's got a personality. He's just really cute. I love him to death. So I love him so much that I would stay up in the middle of the night and not sleep for him, which sleep is a big deal for me.
Yeah, there we go. As well you should. So everybody just be warned. You're going to hear a lot of great baby talk. Is there any place where listeners can go and see this delightful face, or have we not gotten to that point
well,
yet?
Well, we should talk about this because I sort of rage quit the internet a little while ago.
I know.
There isn't
right
really
on.
Anywhere that you can go. We are working on some alternative ways to have some digital fellowship with the Brotherhood. We're not quite ready to
That's
announce
true.
Those things, but I just got to a point, you know, not to make too much of it. I had an interaction online. I don't think there was anything sinful about it. I made a little bit of fun of a just a dumb photo that the faculty at Grace Bible Seminary or whatever, where Owen Strahan are. I made a little bit of fun of just a gross, stupid photo that they took. And I just felt gross. I felt dirty afterwards, not in like a sinful sense, but it was like when you eat too much junk food and it feels really good at the time. And then you're kind of right. like, I feel lethargic. I felt like spiritually lethargic afterwards. So I just like rage quit all the social media. I deleted all my Facebook. I nuked our social media accounts, everything's gone. So we do want to provide some way for people who are part of the Brotherhood to talk to each other in a sort of a separate space from the rest of the internet. We're just not quite ready to announce that yet. So stay tuned for that.
Right. We're reimagining what that looks like, right? In a way that's more healthy, more productive. Yes. Our listeners actually have been fantastic in all those environments. Yeah. But for us, we're trying to put forward something that we think is like the most productive, most biblical, most loving way in which to have those interactions. And there's a lot to feel gross about if we're honest, right? Yeah. Like even if we're not participating in a way that's like overtly sinful, there's a lot that you kind of experience. You're kind of like, ooh, I feel like I need a shower after this. Yeah. So I think we kind of ended up there. So let's get going then. Let's do some affirmations and denials. This is like the first post-baby affirmations and denials. What do you got?
So I'm affirming, let me pull up the article here. I'm affirming a senator from Providence, Rhode Island named Sheldon Whitehouse. And the title of the article, which I was misled by the article, but it's just as good as it sounds. White House sponsored bill would make daylight saving time permanent. I was a little confused when I read it because I was like, the White House is not supposed to be sponsoring bills, but the guy's name is White House. So he is a senator from Rhode Island, and he says daylight saving time or this back and forth stupid thing we do is dumb and we should stop doing it. And I don't have to go much further than that to say other than to say a hearty amen, because it is dumb and we should stop doing it and it makes no sense. So White House for president, I guess. That's my affirmation, is this senator and this bill. This is going to be like the most bipartisan bill ever in history, because it's going to be like 100% of the vote will go for it.
Right. Well, do you have at least like enforced our perennial conviction that it's just easier to like set your clock and keep it that way for all of time? So I totally forgot about that. Although here's what I'll say. I was just recounting this with my wife today. There were several people in our church, several people that showed up late. In fact, as I was leaving, somebody was like, oh, is church already over? And I was like, it's 12:30.
That's funny. That's happened to me before too.
Yeah. Like, well, here's the thing. Like, I'm not trying to be pejorative. I think it happens to all of us at some point. And in fact, my wife and I, we had this debate last night. Which one of our devices can we rely on that will adequately and accurately change the time on us so that we can trust it implicitly, so that we can wake up? We have this whole thing about like which of the devices, like, because we have a couple of clocks that are like take the atomic time in, and then we have, of course, our cell phones and a bunch of other things. But you kind of have to go through that process of like, if you need to for sure get up on time tomorrow, whom can you trust? Yeah.
This is a very real situation for me that happened last night. I'm already sleep deprived, so time confusion is already on the horizon. But it was 1:45, and we had this whole conversation about what time it was okay for me to go wake up the person on the next watch to take it over. I couldn't remember any of that. But I remembered, I'm like, oh, it's daylight saving time switch. I actually watched my cell phone clock go from 1:59 to 3 a.m. It was like a totally surreal experience. So I know for a fact that the Apple environment, Apple phone, everything will automatically update correctly. I watched it happen in real time to go, just an hour of my life just gone, poof, just disappeared. So anyway, all of that to say, the whole thing is dumb and we shouldn't do it.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I love that you have basically put us back into that place here, because I totally forgot that that was like, I'm actually feeling guilty on the inside. I should have also affirmed that. So thank you for bringing us there.
Yes. What about you? What do you got on the affirmation train today?
This is I love the train idea. This is among the easiest for me to affirm. And it's probably like the caboose if we're talking about trains, because there's a lot of more important things we could affirm, but here's one thing. So those who have listened to us for some time know that I'm prone to give some music recommendations. And in particular, I'm prone to give music recommendations that involve a particular band called Wolves at the Gate. Amazing name. You can go and research why biblically they have chosen that for themselves. They're a Christian metal and post-hardcore band from Cedarville, Ohio. They just released a new album. When I say just released, like 3 days ago. It's amazing. It's called Eulogies. Go listen to it. Now I know that, so there's equal parts, like it's melodic. There is a little screaming. You're just going to have to embrace that. You will love it if you listen to it long enough. I know that's not everybody's style. So I'm going to like kind of like take a slight off ramp on the affirmations and do something a little bit that's tangential but related. Here's what I'd also affirm is on the Lord's Day, when you're getting ready, when you're preparing for worship, when you're doing all the things that are necessary before you get out of the door, put on the music of your choice, the genre, whatever it is that you like, that also is focused on praise and worship of the Lord and Savior. Because I'm a firm believer in the fact that what you'll find is that's like an amuse-bouche. It is like the precursor. It's the primer. It's the primer. It's the thing that will get you ready so that when you show up with the Lord's people and they say, it's time to sing, you'll be like, yeah, of course. Like, I'm ready for that. I'm stoked. I'm psyched up. And so this morning, I found myself up early, as is often the case. I'm ironing my shirt, listening to Wolves at the Gate. And so by the time I get to church, I'm like, yes, let's do this thing. So go check out this album called Eulogies by Wolves at the Gate. But also, if that's not your jam, and I'm totally okay with that, then find whatever it is and make that a part of like your normative practice of just the music being on in the background. So there's like this lovely like table setting so that when you get to the Lord's house, you're like, yes, me and my family, we're ready to worship.
Yeah, that's a good affirmation. I find that setting the right tone musically, I don't listen to a lot of music, but there are times when I need to sort of like reset my brain to a new task, or if I'm having a really bad day, sometimes I just need to like reset my brain to be out of that funk. Getting the right kind of music and actually like allowing your body to move with the rhythms and all of that helps to just reset you in a more like holistic way than you might just if you just like sat there and was like, all right, I'm not going to be cranky anymore. If you do that and then put on some happy music and bounce around right with the happy music, then you're more likely to feel a little bit more happy and actually do it. So it's amazing that God has given us, you know, there are religions out there where worship happens entirely in spoken monotone words, right? Or you think of like contexts where worship is one person chanting and everyone else is just sort of listening and just sort of not participating. God has seen fit to give us music in terms of worship that can engage our whole sense of person. But on top of that, like the common grace blessing of music to do that same thing in other contexts is really a blessing that's kind of unparalleled by what other religions have perspectives on music and art about. So it's a good affirmation.
Right on. I'm going to guess that you agree with me on this, but I'm becoming increasingly convinced that it's appropriate and maybe not necessarily commanded. Although I think we can make that argument that both we've talked about the night before the Lord's Day and then really everything leading into the Lord's Day, like there's something to be said for the warm-up. Like the warm-up is necessary and it is important. And it's not that we get more out of it, but that we are more prepared to engage in receiving the means of grace on the Lord's Day when we are primed up for that. Music is one of the easiest ways for us to do that. And I would actually argue that it's one of the best ways to, as you said, kind of reset. So if you find yourself irritated, which who doesn't at some point in time, if you find yourself distracted or busy or overcommitted, that music itself can be a really powerful way that God has given us to help us get that reset and that preset, if you will, for the Lord's Day. So I'm just trying to pack as many things as I can in this affirmation. So mainly it's a recommendation for Wolves at the Gate, but of course.
Well, just theologically, because we always want to come back to that, theologically, and then we'll move on. The command to honor the Sabbath has associated with it all sorts of commands for how to prepare yourself in order to properly honor the Sabbath, right? The Israelites had to gather extra wood the day before. They had to gather more manna the day before. The lambs and things that were going to be used for sacrifices on holy days had to be raised well in advance. They had to be brought to the temple. There was all these things that had to happen before the Sabbath in order to properly sanctify the Sabbath. And so even though we, you know, a lot of those things are part of the ceremonial law, so we're not bound by those in the same way. It's still just good biblical wisdom to recognize, like, if we really want to be able to set apart the Sabbath as holy and all that comes along with that, we don't need to get into the specifics because everybody's got a different perspective on what you can and can't do. And that's almost not the point. There's going to be some work that has to be done. And I don't remember who it was, but somebody was commenting on the Ten Commandments And the commandment for the Sabbath is not just rest on the seventh day it's not just rest on the seventh day. It's work for the 6 days. Yes. 6 days you shall do all your labor, and on the seventh you shall rest. So it's not just, hey, you get a day off. It's also, hey, work hard for the other days. And especially on the sixth day, you got to work hard so that you can properly rest on the seventh day. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's a great recommendation. It's a great way to get prepared mentally. It's a good way to get some energy. It reminds me of that scene in The Office when Dwight goes on the sales call and he's like in his car and he's, I think it's probably like Metallica or something pretty heavy. He's all like jamming out and rocking out. Yes. It's kind of like that, but maybe just a little more mellow.
Yeah, but it's, well, not for me.
Not for you.
But it's like, it's definitely that case, because I was thinking this morning, like generally, and we're not, you know, because oftentimes by God's grace, I'm able to participate in leading people in worship. And so we're playing an instrument or singing together. So we're there early to, of course, rehearse like the final nuances of what that means. And that's important. That oftentimes somebody will lead us in prayer and they'll ask that God, through his Holy Spirit, would enliven us, would open our eyes, would awaken us. This has never been my experience, but I think it's because God is kind to me and like allowing this kind of music and making me interested in that. So like by the time I'm ready to show up, like I might be like too energetic and I don't drink coffee. So like at that time, so like I'm with you. Like there's just something to be said for that. By the way, and I want to acknowledge this, somebody, a great brother, sent us a voicemail, which everybody should do because we love to hear voices, in which he said we should interview or try to interview the lead singer from Wolves at the Gate. I would love to do that. If somebody can make that happen, we will definitely do that, I think, and speak to him, because it's just lovely music and lovely lyrics. So we could go on forever, but what are you denying then against?
Well, I'm gonna cede most of my denial time to either you or to the episode itself, because okay. I'm denying sleep deprivation. So we've already talked a fair amount about why I'm sleep deprived.
There we go.
Whatever.
There we go.
Why I have not slept sufficiently. But I've been thinking a lot about it over the past couple of days. And even as we had a planned date for the delivery. And so I was trying to sleep extra going into it as much as I could. So that way, once we got to the hospital and we got into everything that was going on and all the effects after that, I was ready for it. But it reminds me of the episodes back when we were doing Reformed Preaching, or not Reformed Preaching, when we did Reset by David Murray. Sleep is so important, and there's so much going on with your body that your body just cannot do properly if you do not sleep sufficiently. There's an app that I am not using it right now just because it's sort of not working for me right now, but there's an app called Rise Science that's available for iPhone, and it's especially helpful if you have an Apple Watch. And what it does is actually calculates your sleep debt, and then it makes recommendations about like when you need to go to bed.
Oh, nice.
Gives you recommendations about where to expect your peak energy, what things to avoid, when you should stop drinking caffeine, when you should stop drinking alcohol. But it's really important for us to sleep. And so I'm just denying there's this impulse, particularly in America, in the United States, where busyness is seen as a virtue. And sometimes I only slept for 4 hours. I maintain my life on 5 hours of sleep as kind of a badge of honor. And that's just dumb. Like, it's just dumb. God didn't create us that way. It's actually an attempt for us to try to rule the world our own way. It's our own version of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where we try to be gods on our own. So just don't do it. Like, get good sleep. Take the time you need to get good sleep. There are always going to be seasons of life, like when a new child comes along, or maybe you have a job that requires some extra hours because of a certain task that's associated, or maybe you're in seminary or college where you're just going to get less sleep. And that's okay. But for the most part, God has commanded us to take care of our bodies, and sleep is an important part of that. So I'm not bagging on people that have those sort of occasional reasons to have significant sleep debt or sleep deprivation. But for the most part, we should be sleeping a good 7 or 8 hours, depending on what our body needs. So get on that, people.
Yeah, that's right on. Here's the reason I really like that, because it reminds us that we're contingent beings. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't sleep like the ultimate reminder that you literally need rest to like function in some kind of like productive way? And so, of course, like you said, there's going to be seasons when like you can't get as much as you want or even as much as you need. And I think that God carries us through in his graciousness right. for like legitimate reasons. But I was thinking about this recently because I also have been like, for some reason, waking up at odd hours of the night and being like wide awake, and who hasn't had that experience? And just thinking like how little control also I have over life where I can't sleep. Like sleep seems like the easiest thing, right? Like you go lay in bed, you close your eyes and you wake up. It seems like you need to do nothing for it. And then there's like Psalm 127 too, which says, "In vain you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep." Yeah. And like even that is a gift of God, to be rested, to have, of course, that points to like the eschatological rest, but like even now in the temporal state, we need to be people that are well rested. It changes everything about us, like our continence, our attitudes, the productivity that we're able to have. So I like that because it's just a reminder that like even something that seems so simple, we rely on God for. Yeah. Like to have a good night's rest is something that actually God gives us, not something that we manufacture. For all the things that we might do, the meditation apps, the ability to set it up, those things are helpful. But in the end, that itself is a gift of God, and what a great gift it is. So man, super contingent. I totally appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, and just from a practical standpoint too, every single study that has studied this that I've ever read, and I've been reading a fair number of them, shows that the people who dedicate, you know, let's pretend you have a test in the morning, talking to the college students or the seminary students,
right?
Or your pastor, and there's a sermon you got to prep for, and you're running a little behind, and you just want to put the final touches on it. Every study has shown that you put two people with that same situation next to each other, the person who decides I'm going to go to sleep early and get a good rest, even if that means right they on. Have no prep time in the morning. So they have no time to study. It's not like they're just shifting where the study time is. The person who sleeps more and does not study and has less of the prep time tends to do better. The person who tries to cram and is sleep deprived, that stuff isn't going to lodge in their brain. That's excellent sermon illustration that you came up with at 2:30 in the morning. It's probably not going to be delivered very well. So even from a practical perspective, the ability to sleep is so vital for us to actually perform our duties and our tasks. And this goes into the conversation we were just having about preparing for the Lord's Day. I know a lot of people who stay up really late on Saturday because that's the night they think they can do it. And even most people could sleep in a little bit later on Sunday and still get to church on time. But how aware and how conscious and how able to really take in the sermon and study the word and interact with your brothers and sisters and serve the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. How equipped are you to do that if you're just a walking zombie because you didn't get enough sleep the night before? So affirmations, denials, all of these are kind of intertwined. Like it's really important for us to take care of ourselves and to get ready and to just, God has blessed us with this amazing ability to like manage our internal lives in actually really straightforward, simple ways that are enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, we're just a bunch of idiots and we don't do it most of the time.
Are you saying that like normal, that God uses normal means ordinary to accomplish means. Something That's extraordinary? Weird.
So strange.
Yeah, I agree. I would even go so far as to say like, when we talk about sleep, we're almost talking about like a mini Lord's Day every day in the sense that like God has ordained for us to rest and we must trust him that the rest is valuable because I'm guilty of this. Like on the face, I want to say I could get more done. If I stay up a little bit longer, there's more things that I can accomplish. And what God says basically is like rest, sleep, be well. I will take care of all those things in so much as we work in a way that acknowledges that he is in control without vouchsafing like the fact that we have to put forth the effort and that in so doing, God honors the fact that we're trying to be obedient and faithful to him. But there's like decreasing marginal utility with this. Yeah. Like it's just so easy to think that like, listen, I can stay up a little bit longer. I'll get more done. I'll be more prepared. But man, is that folly. And the Philly scriptures are very clear about that, that sleep and rest is a gift from God. And that like you can't disassociate sleep and rest from the spiritual significance of the one who comes and saves us from all toil, that we toil in a way that is obedient to God, but not in a way that exceeds the line in which he says, you also need to trust me that I will take care of all things. I'm not really good at that. I want to vouchsafe that to myself. And so sleep is like this eternal and contemporary at the same time reminder that God is working all things out and that we are contingent beings. Yeah. So Man, is it possible for us to ever do an affirmation denial where we do not go deep into like spiritual matters?
I was just going to say, I started off that denial by saying, I'm going to cede most of my denial time to the episode. And then we went on to talk about for 10 minutes. So in the spirit of trying to get back on track, what are you denying today, Jesse?
Yes, I'll try to make this like super brief. This is like kind of like an ill-formed denial, but I guess it's like a denial against limiting your understanding of what it means to serve God. So like, I've had this dream for a long time, this amazing dream. And it is, you know, my wife, who's an amazing woman, is intimately involved in our women's ministry at the church. I've had this ongoing joke with her that like, I want to get involved in women's ministry. And just in case it's not clear, I am a dude. So like this by itself has created at least some hurdle to like participating, at least like explicitly in that ministry. But this year,
oh man,
this particular year, I was asked to play guitar this Friday, actually, at a women's ministry event. And it made me so happy, in part because like my wife often leads women's Bible studies. And there have been times more in the distant past when, for instance, like she had a surgical procedure or she was ill and she couldn't, for legitimate reasons, participate in leading that day. And I would say to her, I'm happy to go. Like I can go in and lead women's ministry. And there was like a moment, like a brief moment where there was like complete lucidity. And she said to me, well, like, how would you start that? And I said, well, I just walk in and be like, hello, ladies. And she was like, absolutely not. No, yeah. You cannot do it. So like it's become this ongoing joke. Like I want to participate. And so I was asked to like, which is a great blessing for me to be able to play some music as part of like this women's ministry night. I was so happy and probably in my sinfulness, then I turned this around to be like, yes,
finally, I'm in.
I get to be a part of, yeah, I'm in women's ministry. So, I'm just like loving the fact that like, I understand that we kind of create at times, like for good reason, compartmentalization in the way that we minister to one another. But like this wonderful crossover for me has been just such a great blessing. So maybe it's an affirmation in disguise, but just being open and being appreciative, but also like if you're part of your church who does like various ministries and they're trying to reach particular people, I think there's sometimes the sense that like we need to break down all the walls. Sometimes those segments are really helpful, yeah, and really important. They create space for trust and for love and safety, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to embrace those, and it's also wonderful to embrace when you might have like some small amount of crossover. And I tell you what, loved ones, I'm going to be super stoked. By the time you hear this, like it's on the same day, if you're listening to it on Friday, that evening, I'm going to be able to play. It's a dream come true for me to be able to pray.
I'll
also
too.
Be praying, playing, for a women's ministry event, which is going to be a great joy for me. And I think it's going to be a blessing to nice. Me. So
you're going to do Wolves at the Gate
I'm super
songs?
Stoked.
I would name a Wolves at the Gate song that you could do, but I don't know any. So
yeah, that's fair. Although in the new album, I thought of you particularly, Tony, because they don't reference it explicitly, but the name of the song is Kiss the Wave.
Oh,
I think
nice.
We know where that comes from.
From nowhere, yeah. Totally from thin air, but apparently from C.H. Spurgeon.
You got that right. They don't reference him.
We should make, maybe this is like maybe me, you, and Conrad project. We should make an album of songs that's like screamo music, but it's all about trashing heresies.
I feel like
that would be a bestseller in the Reformed world.
I would love like the heresy album, and we just like each track is like directed at a particular.
Yeah,
heresy.
It'd be like the. We'd have to have some like just rad name, rad. Just some like really epic.
Yes, I love
killer
that.
Name for each song. It just like rips apart a heresy.
I love that. Here's the thing: Conrad's texting me right now.
He doesn't
that.
Even know like, why. Yeah. He felt a tremor in the right. force, and he got really excited about it.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me at all. All right. So I don't know how long we've gone on, but this is like epic affirmations and denials. Post-baby, everybody, listen. Tony had an adorable, cute baby whose name is August. This episode, you just got to give us some grace on that. But let's talk about free fall. Let's get into this because we're tracking along, of course, in this like never-ending series of really trying to understand all things theology. And we have a particular purpose and a particular order in doing that. We talked about superlapsarianism, infralapsarianism. Was that the last episode?
Yeah.
It seems like
it feels like a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. All right. So like this makes sense. Let's talk about pre-fall. So where do we go from here?
Yeah. So So there's always a question mark when you're doing a systematic theology sequence. We've talked about this a little bit before, that you have to, the way that things work, you have to put them in a sequence. So there's always a question mark of, do you include anthropology as a whole? You know, do you do the entire study of man, including man's constitution prior to the fall, after the fall? And then sometimes even people will include kind of eschatological anthropology as part of that as well. So they take all of the doctrine of man, they put it in one spot. Other ways to do it, and this is the way we're going, at least this time around, is you take anthropology and you kind of break it up into its sections, and then you locate those sections within broader other things. So we're locating pre-fall anthropology, so the doctrine of man prior to the fall, as part of creation. And just to be transparent about it, the reason we're doing that is because this is the way the Bible does it, right? Not every systematic theology can be arranged in a biblical order in terms of like following an order that the Bible does, because that's not how the Bible is arranged. But in terms of how God presents to us the doctrine of creation and then the doctrine of the pre-fall state of man, that is assumed within the broader doctrine of creation. And so we talked a little bit about how sometimes the more liberal perspectives will take Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they'll see them as like two totally disparate creation accounts. And sometimes they try to harmonize them. Sometimes they just say they're just different and you're not going to be able to harmonize them. But the doctrine of what man is like prior to the fall is not exclusively presented in Genesis 2, but is largely presented in Genesis 2. And so anytime you talk about pre-fall anthropology, when the rest of the Bible talks about the image of God or talks about marriage and what the pre-fall, the ideal state of marriage is, all of those things point back to the creation narrative. They point back to Genesis 2. And so although I understand and I don't think it's illegitimate to talk about pre-fall anthropology as part of a broader anthropology discussion, I actually think the best way to do it is to root it in the same place the Bible does, which is right there in the creation account itself. And then as you get into anthropology proper, if you need to talk about image of God, which you do, because you need to talk about post-fall image of God, then you kind of you backtrack and you reference what you've already said. So that's where we're going today, is we're going to camp out mostly in Genesis 2. There's a lot of things we're not going to have time to talk about. We're not going to talk about complementarianism versus egalitarianism.
Right.
We did a whole episode on that. We probably will talk about that again in the future within this section. We're not going to do that today. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about like, what's the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Is it a particular fruit? We're not going to talk about that. That's a totally different part of the sequence we'll probably talk about down the road when we get to either soteriology, sacramentology. I mean, there's other places to locate that. But what we're going to focus on today is a couple different thoughts about the different ways people read Genesis 2. We're not going to go anywhere as in-depth as we did in the Genesis 1 episodes we just did. They'll follow the same kinds of tracks. There's sort of the mythological readings of Genesis 2 that don't think, or the naturalist ones that we don't think work. And then there's maybe a couple different ways people might look at Genesis 2. So we'll briefly touch on that. But I'm excited about this episode because this is the part of systematic theology where it feels like things start to accelerate towards the cross. And that's always really exciting to me is, you know, you can get bogged down in prolegomena and you can get bogged down in like the doctrine of the Bible. It's really important stuff, but it feels so abstracted and separated. Even the doctrine of creation sometimes feels like, creation, I get it. Like, let's get to the gospel. Once you get to pre-fall anthropology, it's like all of a sudden you hit a different grade on the hill and you start to accelerate. So I'm really excited to start moving forward with this stuff.
Right. I'm with you. Incidentally, in case anybody's like tracking with us or keeping score at home, of course, as you know, chapter 2 of Genesis starts with the seventh day and God resting. So even there we have like, it's like wonderful pedigree. So we have this idea that, you know, the setting for us is that God has set aside this particular day. And it just so happens that usually is the day that you and I record, which is like, I actually consider a great blessing that even in this conversation, it's being born out of the sense that like we're honoring the seventh day by thinking and devoting ourselves to the things of God. And in doing that, this is a great joy for us. Like, though this is in some ways, man, get ready, like the theonomists are going to go crazy right now. Like in the sense that like, this is work. It is like a good and glorious work. Of course, like we're putting in the effort to do this. And there's a lot of technical pieces that come together as you all hear them in your ears and through your phones or whatever devices that you use. that have to come together. But at the same time, it is wholly an act of love, and that this is the thing that sets us right, starts the week off. And so we have in Genesis 2, that's the precursor. So, and then we come to, like, of course, like the creation of man and woman and all the generations, all the things that come about as a part of that. So I actually think that what happens is we skip over this oftentimes, and so we like just fail to understand like the setting. So we're so quick to come to like, there's the serpent and there is the fall. But like, what about everything that preceded that? And I think we have episodes, maybe epic episodes, if you will, definitive episodes, if you will, on complementarianism and superlapsarianism and infralapsarianism. And then all the stuff that matters of like, even like the probation period of what it meant for man to be in this particular state, all of this must be and should be necessary in our understanding of everything that comes after that. Like the gospel is like this amazing news, but of course it is heightened in relief because of everything that happens pre the fall. So I think it's just like important to like get a little bit conception. Like this would be like the color commentary in like a sporting event, like trying to understand the way in which the team got to the place in which it was, right? Like this is the thing that helps us understand the current achievement that comes through Christ.
Yeah. One more thing just to mention before we get into sort of really talking about Genesis 2. I had one of our listeners, very gracious brother, contact me after listening to a couple of the Last Creation episodes and just sort of question whether we had accurately represented a few things. And after talking with him, I think he and I still don't agree necessarily on theistic evolution was the specific one he was kind of saying. I'm not sure you quite captured that. But I think it's important to say the views that we were calling the mythological views or the naturalistic views that we said, if you come to the scripture and think Genesis 1 is a mythology or you're approaching it with more or less naturalistic presuppositions, those are views that we believe are excluded from biblical orthodoxy. And then we talked about the basically what we might call like a literalist view that Genesis 1 just is what it says it is. And there's not really anything fancy to how we reconcile that. It's just a straightforward historical account. And then there's the framework view, or we might call it like symbolic or representative view. That's not coming with a mythological view, but it's maybe a little bit closer to that. So I guess if you were to put it on a spectrum, there's like the naturalist view on the far left, and then there's the mythological view on the unorthodox side of the spectrum. And then there's maybe the framework view or the symbolic view, the accommodative view, something like that on the orthodox side of that spectrum. And then there's just the straight, like literalist, everything is exactly as it says it is. There's nothing that isn't really face value. That's not to say that you can't hold elements of something on one part of the spectrum and still also hold elements on the other. So his specific thing was like, well, you could hold to a literary framework view and also still hold to an evolutionary view because those two aren't incompatible. That's true. Our goal wasn't to try to like, put together every possible permutation, but to just recognize there are these broad categories. And for the first most principles. Part, the ones on the left, they come with presuppositions we can't hold and they lead us to bad conclusions. The ones on the right, they come with presuppositions we can hold and they lead us to good or better conclusions. So I think that's important because there's a similar kind of dynamic that happens with this text. So real quickly, I'm just going to run through an outline or a contour of what the Genesis 2 text actually says. And so it starts off with this this phrase, which tells us that this is a new section, right? Hebrew doesn't have chapters. They don't have headings like that. But there's this repeated phrase called a toledot phrase in Genesis that shows us the broad sections. You can think of it like chapter markers. And it's this phrase, these are the generations. And usually that phrase is followed by a name of a person or a name of a family. And that tells you that the subsequent text is the account of that person's lineage or family. Right. So it says these are the generations of Abraham or of Noah. And then the story that follows it is the flood or the, you know, Mesopotamian wandering, whatever. The Genesis 2 text says these are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created. And so what that tells us is to reaffirm what I said earlier is that Genesis 2, although it focuses in on the creation of man and the creation of the first married couple and the task assigned to them, this is still the story or the account of the creation of the universe. So it's important, even though this is a second chapter, not only a second chapter in terms of how we number it, but it's a second section We were kind of framing Genesis 1 almost as like a prologue. This is the first real chapter of it, but it's a continuation of everything that happened in there. So we shouldn't separate out Genesis 1 and 2. This is the textual reason that we shouldn't separate out Genesis 1 and 2 too strongly, because there's this link that shows them together. So we zoom in on creation. We're doing a little bit of a flashback, because we start off in verse 5. There's no bush of the field in the land. There's no plant. There's the Lord did not cause rain on the land, and there was no man.
Right.
So we're in this sort of like, it's not quite the tohu vavohu. It's not the formless and void state of Genesis 1-3. It's something closer to the final state, but not quite formalized yet. It's hard to map these up to the specific days because the ordering is a little bit different. There are useful ways to harmonize them. We're not going to get into that right now, but there are ways to harmonize this. But it zooms in on this sort of pre-created or pre-organized state of the world after the land had been gathered together. Then God creates a man that he then puts into a garden that God had planted. So it's not as though the text is saying there was a garden and then God created a man. It's God created a man first, and then he places this man in the garden. So that tells you something about the order and purpose of things. God did not create the garden, or did not create man to till a garden that already existed. He created a garden as a home for the man and a task for the man. So the garden is subservient to the man in terms of the task and the order of things. The man takes priority over the garden. So God puts the man in the garden. There's all this information about what the garden looks like, the rivers that flow around it, the rich land, the gold, the jewels, all this different stuff that's painting this picture of the garden as this rich, lush place of wealth and blessing and fruitfulness. Right? That's really important, because the garden here is seen as the pinnacle of God's created realms. It's not the pinnacle of creation, but it's the pinnacle of the worlds, the realms that God has created, the spheres of authority, or whatever you want to say, that God's created. In some ways, this is even more glorious than what we see talked about when God describes heaven. Right?
Right.
When you go to Genesis, or when you go to the end of the Bible and you go to Revelation, and the final state of things, the heaven and earth uniting and coming down, that is described like this. So this is both a foreshadowing of what is to be the final eschatological state, but also at this point, this is the pinnacle. This is the best place to live. Adam didn't live in heaven. He wasn't created and placed in heaven. He was created in this lush placed in this lush garden. After it describes the garden and all of the things, then it describes the man's task, which is to work and expand that garden. And then it describes this creation of woman as a way to sort of complete the human race, to enable the human race to fulfill its task, to not only multiply the garden and to tend and keep the garden and expand its borders, but to multiply humanity itself, to multiply the image of God out into that now expanded garden border. And so the chapter ends with this statement that a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife. A lot of times that portion, right, verse 23 through 25 gets read at a wedding. That leads us to take it out of the context of everything else. The reason that a man leaves his wife or leaves his family to be cling to his wife, holds fast to his wife, is not so much this leave and cleave principle that predominantly Western Christianity has adopted. In Eastern Christianity, I don't mean Eastern Orthodox Christianity, but Protestant Christianity in Eastern context, this idea that you leave your family of origin to be married to your wife is totally alien to them. They don't get it, and it doesn't make sense to them. This is more about the expansion of the human race. It's not just one family. We're multiplying persons, but we're also multiplying family units. So that's the broad contours of the text, right? We start off with a man. God builds a home for him and commands him to maintain and expand his home. And then as he maintains and expands his home, he makes other families that then create and maintain and expand their homes until ultimately the goal is for man to populate the whole world and to make it into this universal garden temple where all people worship the Lord together. It's important for us to ground that, because anything we're going to say about the ability to sin or not to sin, all of that stuff that we're going to talk about, none of that really makes a lot of sense unless we ground it in this context. And when we talk about the views that don't work, most of the views that don't work also can't accommodate that kind of context. They just right. don't make sense of the text. Even if you read this as a metaphorical statement, what the metaphor is communicating doesn't work with things like the evolution of Adam, the evolutionary Adam view, which I'll talk about in a second. But we have to understand what the text is trying to say. It's about God creating image bearers who represent him on the earth and then expand that representation and expand the authority and the realm of that representation right. to fill the entire earth. And that's a very common right. theme in prophecy as well.
Yeah. And at this point, again, we almost have to immerse ourselves in the text with respect to what God is doing in like this kind of temporal order. At this point, everything else that you kind of said was like a little bit outside the scope doesn't even matter, because what we're saying is that God, as he is setting forth his creation, is basically like syndicating his children, right? It's this idea that like he's saying, listen, when you propagate, you're creating more quote unquote Christians, in the sense that, of course, like all of those whom God has chosen are Christians, even if we don't understand that in like the New Testament sense. And so at this moment, at this very moment, the way in which you get more Christians is to be fruitful and multiply, right? Yeah. Like that's the way it happens. It's actually, in point of fact, the only way it happens at this moment. Right. So like, kudos to you, sir. So like, I mean that like very literally, in the sense that like only when we get the New Testament, when Paul, in his like kind of like typical Pauline way, when he talks about like what it means to be like fathers and mothers of like a spiritual sense, do we have like almost like a... like there's like two paths to this, in the sense that like, and I'm trying not to get into papal baptism really hard right here, but like this, you know what I'm saying? Like in the sense that like there is a way in which we might be spiritual fathers and mothers, but in this particular moment, we just have to be honest with the fact that like the way that God has organized creation is to like propagate the earth and syndicate the earth with his children by way of procreation. And you and I are not the only ones that feel this way. Like in point of fact, like I kind of felt like what you were saying was very similar to what our Lutheran in residence, Chad Bird, has said about the fact that like the order in which God has like establishing things matters. So he creates, as you said, like mankind, he placed them in the garden. And in some sense, the idea of the garden is to like push out on all the boundaries, like to expand this microcosmic revelation in a way that spreads across the whole earth, in which mankind is taking dominion as they expand their physical population in a way that propagates the people and the children of God. This is the way that he set things up. So again, there's, as we have been prone to say, there's no plan B here.
Right.
It's not as if like this thing unfolded in a way that was like suboptimal. And so God was like, listen, I'm going to turn this thing around and totally redeem this thing. Here we have God working from the very beginning in the way that God always works. And so I just think it's important. I like what you're saying here. Like it's important to think about these things. Like in many ways, we have the way in which God continues to bring about like his people by the way of like this kind of like spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood, in which we find that he is pushing forward the gospel. This is even in some ways like more glorious than the beginning, but it exactly roots to the beginning. Yeah. And unless we appreciate what the beginning was like in the way that God had established all of creation, when we appreciate that, what we find is that God has redeemed and created these supernatural relationships that are even better than the natural ones. But we fail to consider that unless we go exactly in the direction that you have already established here.
Yeah. And so there's a few, I think some views that are maybe not popular among Reformed Christians, but I think sometimes have some appeal, right? And the reason there's some appeal for what I'm about to say, I think, is because there's a serious desire to take the text at face value. But also the Reformed, more so than our Lutheran brothers and sisters, maybe about the same as our Arminian brothers and sisters, because they do come out of a more Reformed way of thinking in terms of how we approach Scripture and trying to make logical coherence significant. There's a desire to have a logical coherence with not only what the Scriptures teach, but also what we understand from the light of nature, right? The Reformed perspective, the Reformed confessional position, is that God doesn't just speak to us in the Scriptures, but he also speaks to us through the natural world. And so I totally understand the impulse when someone looks at the natural order, they look at science, and they look at what science teaches us, although that's kind of a fraught phrase, the science teaches us. But they look at the insight that we've gathered from the natural sciences, from observations of the natural world. And they want to rely on those. They want to trust those. And by and large, that's a good thing, right? Gravity is real. So we can draw logical conclusions based on gravity. And if there was some strange interpretation of the Bible out there where a particular verse seemed to say gravity didn't exist, then we should maybe question that interpretation and say there's probably more, there seems to be more going on in this text or something else going on in this text than the idea that gravity is not real, that objects don't actually fall to a center of mass. That right. said, when people take this view and they apply it to evolution, theistic evolution is the hallmark of this, but they take insights gained by evolutionary sciences and they then try to synthesize the Genesis 2 account, and they come up with this thing called the evolutionary Adam hypothesis, or like the ensouled ape hypothesis. And the idea is that the ordinary mechanism of evolution, superintended by God, either directly or providentially, however that works out, and there's different variations. But basically, evolution happens more or less how Darwinianism describes it, starting off with these single-celled organisms or inorganic molecules that spontaneously become organic molecules that then, through series of change, become more complex and more complex until you end up with hominids. And then God picks one of those hominids and breathes the breath of life into it and gives them a soul, and that's Adam. There are a number of problems with that interpretation. Even if we get past conversations about God using death prior to the fall, right? We can talk about that on some other, we'll talk about that when we talk about the fall. But my position, I believe Jesse's position, is that death, even in animals for the most part, is a product of the fall. Right. That is not the universal position, even within Orthodox Christianity. There are Christian thinkers who hold Orthodox understandings that would say, well, you know, plants are alive and animals had to eat plants, so there's some level of death happening in the garden, right? I get all of that. Yeah, that was not a sound from the Lord. I hit my microphone stand. I'm like, boom, 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 boom. That said, though, there are a number of theological problems that come about with this evolutionary hypothesis, the ensouled ape hypothesis, whatever you want to call it.
For sure.
Namely, it doesn't make any sense of what we've just articulated, the main thrust of the text is. Right? Because the text is presenting this situation where God's first, more or less first direct creative act is to create man, right? We have Genesis 1 and it's this big overview where God is indirectly creating things. He's not getting his anthropomorphic hands dirty, as it were. He's not involved in creation other than by fiat. He says, let this be, and then it is. When we get to Genesis 2, it's all about God interacting with creation in a more direct level to bring about his plan, right? He forms the man out of the dust. He plants the garden in Eden. He takes the rib from the man. He puts him to sleep. He closes up. All of these are direct interactive verbs that God is engaged in versus chapter one, which is all God said and let it be. God said and let it be. He's very removed from any direct interaction. Well, the evolutionary hypothesis, the ensouled ape hypothesis, gets this order wrong. God doesn't create the world and then pick a man out of the world. He creates a man and then he creates the task for the man based on that. He's not selecting from an already existing group of apes and choosing to make this one Adam. Now, there are all sorts of other issues that I think we're going to have to pass down to next time, to when we talk about the fall, that have to do with the fact that if this is true and the only real difference between Adam and his ape neighbor that has all the same biological capacities, well, yeah, he's not a moral creature. So would it have been okay for that ape to murder another ape? I guess maybe we would say that. Like, nobody is taking gorillas to court when they kill another gorilla. But that doesn't seem to make sense of the text. This process of evolution and ensoulment has all sorts of questions for federal headship and salvation and soteriology that we will push down the road. But I thought it was important to at least get that out there, that when we have a text that seems to be placing the creation of man as the primary motivation of this chapter, that everything that happens after that is involved with giving this man that God has created his task, his purpose, his location, his ultimate aim, right? You could say like this chapter is about describing for us what the chief end of man is. It's to glorify right. God through expanding his kingdom on the earth and to enjoy him forever by fellowship, which is what we see in the garden. All of that is dependent on man being created and logically supreme in this chapter. The evolutionary hypothesis has to flip that over on its head, and it makes man sort of an effect of the world rather than the cause, the formal cause or the final cause of the world. The world was created, as we know it, as it's described in Genesis 2, for the purpose of the man. Just like when Jesus says that God gave man was not made for the Sabbath, the Sabbath was made for man, right? What it's saying right. is that man is the primary thought unit, and the Sabbath is subservient to that. The evolutionary hypothesis just flips that around in a way that doesn't do justice to the text.
Right. Yeah, that's right on. Man, I feel like we need to like kind of land the plane now because
maybe we should.
Yeah, otherwise we'll just go into 6 or 7 or 8 more hours of all this kind of good stuff. So yeah, I think hopefully what we provided here is in some ways like a setting. Maybe it's just straight prolegomena. I've realized that like I think we do a lot of prolegomena more than we think
we do
on this podcast. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
Is it possible that we've done all these 280 odd episodes and it's all prolegomena?
I don't know. It's possible, I guess. But yeah, let's spread this out to the next episode. So this episode is kind of like setting the table, right? We've put the setting together. We've showed you what the landscape is and why it's important. Right. And now next week we'll kind of unpack for you what specifically the text tells us about all of that. What is the purpose of man? How does he function in the garden? Why does God create a helper for him? All of those things we'll touch base on. I shouldn't say all of those things because I'm committing ourselves to something we probably can't fulfill on. We'll touch on those things and we'll talk about those things next week on another episode about this pre-fall anthropology stuff.
Yeah, I love that. And in the meantime, if you want to get involved with the podcast in a, let's say, a more profound way, and of course, we appreciate both people who think of us, who listen to us, who share the episodes. I want to thank in particular Brother Michael, who jumped into, we have this little fun kind of store of some things that we sell, has our logo on it, and a portion of the proceeds of those things, they all go to support the podcast. He would jumped into that this particular past week. Maybe you noticed that too. He has some excellent t-shirts coming his way, which, you know, like, yeah, listen, your face and mine on somebody's chest emblazoned just out there in the public. You can't go wrong with that. But if you go to reformbrotherhood.com, there's a bunch of things you can do, including going out and checking out that little store that we have, supporting us through patreon.com. All of these things make sure in many ways that all of what you're hearing is totally free. You're never going to be charged for that. So we're so thankful for those who, as God has allowed them and enabled them to come alongside and support financially to do that. We are so thankful because there's, as you've heard us say before, surprisingly, shockingly, a number of incidental costs that make this like sound good in your ears and make sure it downloads with like reasonable speed so that you're not waiting like 6 hours to like hear this episode. So thank you. We love you. Thank you. We love all those who are part of this. So come and do that. What are other ways that people can get involved, Tony?
Yeah, right now you can call us and leave a voicemail. We've started getting some good voicemails. So once we get out of this little section of our series, we'll jump in and do a question cast. You can reach us at 607-444-2767, which spells out bros. And you can leave a voicemail. We do like short voicemails because we want to hear your voice, but we want to also make sure that the episode has enough time to address your questions. Please don't leave your personal phone number on there. We've had people do that and we can't use your voicemail. If you desire to leave a message, but you live outside of the United States and don't want to dial long distance to call us, I suppose if you want to call long distance, you can. You can record a voice memo and email it to info@reformbrotherhood.com. And we will treat that with the same scale that we treat voicemails. You can email us at that same email address with your question, although we will say we give voicemails considerable privilege in terms of selecting what comes on the question cast. Right. And you know, I think the thing we don't often ask for is go to iTunes or Spotify and leave a review. Those reviews don't do a lot in terms of the algorithm of putting us in like the leader charts or making it so we're more likely to be found in search engines. But what they do is when someone looks at the episode or the podcast and they want to say, is this worth my time? They're going to look at those comments a lot of times. They're going to look at the star ratings. So give us a honest review. We like to hear positive and critical feedback. But we would appreciate reviews on both of those platforms as well.
Man, that was excellent. It was like we rehearsed that.
We didn't. I promise we didn't.
Yeah, listen, loved ones, we're in this together. And after all these episodes, we really so much covet the feedback, the participation in this whole process. And for those that have been with us for some length of time, I mean, anybody can go back and listen to episode one. I mean, I prefer you don't do that, but you can definitely go back and do that and see the extent to which like we're trying in real time as a process for Reformed theology and what it means to follow closely after the Lord Jesus Christ, not just in mind, not just giving intellectual assent to all the things we talked about today, but at the end of the day, as R.C. Sproul would say, in the final analysis, apparently, what does it mean to internalize these things into the essence of our being? And so in that way, practice them, practice them in a way that brings honor to our Lord and Savior. That's what we're after. So I love that people are down with that mission and intimately involved with us in that. So get involved. Jump in. Go to the website. There's like, what, seven things?
Yeah, but most of them are social media and they don't work anymore because I went on a rage quit and deleted a bunch of them. We'll get that updated once we get this new venue that we're working on put out there. But yeah, we're excited to continue making content for you. We're excited to take questions. We're excited to talk about the things that are important and that you find important. So please leave us a voicemail. Please send us a question. You know, a lot of times we get a good question in email and we don't necessarily use it for a voicemail or for a question cast, but it turns into an episode because we get the question. We go, well, this doesn't really work for like a short snippet, but we want to do a whole episode on it. And we will be taking some breaks here and there in this ongoing series to address topical things and questions that come in. But until next time, Jesse, this is like the best, most rapid transition ever. I have no ability to think on my feet at this point. I barely have the ability to stand on my feet at this point.
You're doing great.
Until next time, Jesse, honor everyone.
Love the brotherhood.